So, let's see. One second, I'll be right back. So we're beginning. So the next presentation, as you can see here on the screen, entitled American Vedic by Varnashrama in Modern Times by Abhiram Prabhu. There's so many things that we can say about Abhiram Prabhu's history of service. Perhaps most relevant for us is that Abhiram Prabhu was Srila Prabhupada's servant, nurse, and caretaker for a large part of 1977, which, as we've heard, was some of the main times that Srila Prabhupada focused on Varnashram. And he's done many other services. I'll just mention one, because it's something that for anyone who's ever visited Vrindavan, they've had direct pratyaksha, direct experience of that, and that is that he designed and helped lead the MVT, that beautiful property just behind the Krishna Balaram temple, which has a beautiful guest house and residences, and has many, many devotees have found solace in their pilgrimages to Vrindavan and recharging their spiritual batteries due to the work that Abhiram Prabhu put in for decades to conceive of, develop, build, and maintain that beautiful property. So please welcome His Grace Abhiram Prabhu.
Thank you, Braj Bihari Prabhu. I pray that my words will do justice to my divine master, Srila Prabhupada. And I feel very privileged to have been given the opportunity to be a messenger, because obviously in so many ways, the words that Srila Prabhupada spoke, either formally or informally, were all intended to be insightful and instructive for generations to come, not just the time that he was apparently on the earth physically. So also, if the Vaishnavas assembled and the Vaishnavas who are listening to this from afar will give me their blessings, then perhaps we can somehow together progress our understanding and gain insights into Srila Prabhupada's desire. And his desire is our salvation. So, as was mentioned, I spent most of 1977 with Srila Prabhupada, not always as an official member of his party, but I was just prior to that the temple president of Calcutta. So I used my perceived authority to ditch out of my temple president service and travel everywhere with Prabhupada. So from December 76, and there was quite a lot of interaction before that in India. But for much of 77, I was with him, Kumbh Mela, various Bhubaneswar, various places that he traveled in 77. And during this time, Srila Prabhupada, of course, became very ill, and he became aware that this illness may not pass. And actually, interestingly, we had invited Srila Prabhupada to perform a fire sacrifice. I was the first householder to build a house at Mayapur. And it's still there above the Goshala, that little three-story building. And Srila Prabhupada, being aware it was constructed, he spoke to us about it, and my wife invited him to perform the fire, and he agreed. And so that was the plan, and he was becoming ill. And Tamal Krishnamurti suggested that he not go, and Prabhupada said, no, I must go, they'll be disappointed. So we heard that, and on the appointed day when he was to come and do the fire, we were painfully aware of how much trouble it would be for him. So my wife and I decided to ask him to please stay in his room and not come, and we did that. And that particular day was the last day that Srila Prabhupada actually went out of his room and moved around. And from that point, he gradually faded until he passed away from this world. So later in that year, in the summer, Srila Prabhupada saw me visiting him in Vrindavan. I had been traveling with him quite a bit, and my wife had been his cook for a number of years on and off. And he saw me in the crowd, and he told Tamal that Abhiram is here. Ask him to stay. So I started staying there. And the theme of Srila Prabhupada's talks, informal talks in his room, and when I say talks, these were no longer formal darshans where groups of devotees would come. There were just a few senior devotees and a few of us who were serving him. And the things that he would mention followed a certain theme. And in one of those conversations, I'll elaborate a little bit more in the next slide, but in one of those conversations, Srila Prabhupada was referring to his body deteriorating and his impending death. And he mentioned Nasojati, Nakanchati, I have no any hankering nor lamentation. And Brahmananda, we were all kind of surprised that he was saying this. Of course, many things Prabhupada said were surprising. Brahmananda Prabhu asked him, Srila Prabhupada, you mean that you didn't finish Srimad Bhagavatam? And Prabhupada said, no, because I have not established Varnashram. So Tamal Krishna was in the room, Brahmananda was in the room, Upendra was in the room. All of them, unfortunately, are now departed. I was also in the room. I was massaging Srila Prabhupada's hand at that time. So, within this period of time, there was a continuing repeat of this theme. But I want to mention here that as Pancharatna Prabhu reminded me earlier, and our very wise Mata, who keeps bringing up points, also reminded us that in this time, there was a great concern of the fall downs. Prabhupada was becoming increasingly in anxiety about the fall downs. I remember when one was being reported to him, he said, he was shaking his head and he just said, but he promised. It was an inconceivable thing to a person of his character that a person could make a promise and not keep the promise. It was shocking to him. And this news of various fall downs, of course, had been going on, and it was accumulating as he was feeling at the same time that imminent exit door that was being presented him, that it was time for him to go. And he was aware that his movement was not yet very strong. Earlier on, Srila Prabhupada was preaching that we all come to the stage of at least Madhya Madhukari instantly. There was, in fact, if you look at Prabhupada's preaching, there was no accommodation for Kanishtadhikari. It was not considered. It was considered a disease, not a stepping stone. Right? You came to Madhyam, and then right away you should be moving into Uttamadhikari. Prabhupada was preaching to establish pure devotional service. As the society grew, as the practical problems became more and more apparent, as even senior sannyasis were falling down, Srila Prabhupada became more and more aware of the circumstances, and as his impending departure became imminent, he became more concerned. So during this time, Srila Prabhupada decided to travel to the West, even though it was very ill-advised from a medical point of view. His condition was very precarious. And by this time, he couldn't really walk, but he was such a lion of a personality that he refused to be carried or put in a wheelchair or anything like that. So what we used to do, I often did this, I would have to stand behind him and put my hands under his armpits and take the weight of his body, and his feet would shuffle as if he were walking. But still he kept the dignity that he was walking. Right? So this is like a great king. You know, he was very, very dignified. But his condition was very precarious. He was not at all well. Yet he decided to go to the West. And so while the arrangements were being made, Srila Prabhupada kept repeating about, I want to go to the West, even at the risk of my life. It will encourage my disciples. And he said, I will establish Varnashram. And numerous times he mentioned this. So back in 7, Srila instruction about Varnashram. And that was when I was at TP of Miami, and I went to see him at Henry Street in New York. And we had a basically private conversation. I think, in fact, Shrutikirti just reminded me the other day, Shrutikirti Prabhu, that he was there, he was present. And Srila Prabhupada was talking to me about Miami Temple, and I said to him then, I was thinking of expanding into a farm, Srila Prabhupada. In Florida, Disney has so many thousands of acres, and they have a Disney World. And Prabhupada said, yes, make Vaikuntha World. Chaturvarna mayom shustam. So that was still burned into my mind, and as a hippie, I had been one of these people trying to make communes and thinking about communes and such things. So we were utopians in many ways. So while this theme was going on about Varnashram, it really was very interesting to me. And of course that Prabhupada was so concerned about it, made it so interesting. So one afternoon, late afternoon, we were on Srila Prabhupada's roof in the cottage in Vrindavan. And he was sitting on his charpoy, the rope bed. And I was attending to him. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj was running in and out with information about the tickets and the timing. And that was going up, and he was going back to the phone and, you know, calling travel agents and this sort of thing. So in the middle of this, I waited till everyone was gone, and I said, Srila Prabhupada, what will you do to establish Varnashram? And that's when he said to me, I will go to Gita Nagari, I will sit down, and I will teach you how to live off the land. Of course, at that time, Gita Nagari had Paramananda, who was also known as Farmananda, probably. Mind-boggling amounts of food. Prabhupada was getting regular reports. And Prabhupada loved Gita Nagari. It was a wonderful farm. It was primarily the only good, really good farm we had in the movement at the time. And it is and was known as an excellent farm, excellent land, excellent farming conditions. So Prabhupada made these statements. I will go to Gita Nagari. I will sit down and I will teach you to live off the land. I'm going to return to these individual parts of the phrase during this talk, because I have over the years turned them in my head 1,000 times or more and thought about the relevance and what they meant, what exactly he meant. Srila Prabhupada didn't just throw words into a phrase just to fill it up. Every syllable had a specific reason for being there. So I'm going to take a stab at elaborating on what those words might have meant and what they can mean to us today. So I'd like to propose that this phrase, I will sit down and I will teach you how to live off the land, is the Bij mantra, or a Bij mantra. It's at least Prabhupada's Bij mantra to me, and to all of you who find it relevant to your devotional service. How Varnashram will begin? That was the question I asked him. How will you do it? And he didn't say, well, we'll learn how to ride around on horses with swords, or will, you know, he didn't say like that. He talked about living off the land. So, he talked about sitting down. If you look at Srila Prabhupada's early days in preaching, he didn't think, I'm going to go to Tompkins Square Park, I'm going to gather the hippies around me, and they're all going to join up, and then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that. I doubt if he had ever heard the word hippie when he landed in New York City. And if he had, it was a very, very vague concept. Right? He didn't know if he was going to be preaching uptown, downtown, out of town, or heading back to India in a short time. But he sat down. He sat down. And he took the opportunities that came forward. He interacted with them. It was iterative. Huh? Things came to him. Krishna brought different persons, different opportunities, and Prabhupada took advantage of them. Right? He didn't come with a business plan. You know, he didn't have his MBA graduation formatted business plan. Right? He was opportunistic. The opportunities that Krishna gave him, he took advantage of them. And he also experimented as he moved through the preaching process, the growth of the movement. He tried different things. Some things didn't work. Some things he canceled. Some things were quite extreme in some of his ideas and later canceled them. There was a time in the movement, just to illuminate how extreme it could be. I was a TP in early days in Miami, and I received a letter from Srila Prabhupada saying, and it was a letter written to all the TPs, that there are so many women in our movement who are not getting shelter. All of the temple presidents should take a second wife. This is a historical fact. I'm sorry. It actually happened. A month later, we got a letter reversing that. And that was because some of the leading devotees sat in with Prabhupada and explained that, you know, the governments and the religions and the people of these countries will basically drive us into the sea if we try to do that. So he canceled it. So this is iterative. Right? Sit down. He said, I'll sit down in Gita Nagari. Does it mean he knew how to work a greenhouse? He may have heard of a greenhouse. He may have seen something, a picture of a greenhouse. He may have seen one driving by in a car. But he had to sit down and start working with it. Hear the problems as the devotees come back and explain. We've tried this. It's not working. Let's do this. Let's do that. This is the process of sitting down. He wanted to do that. Teach. Now, this theme is repeated in many lectures, the Varnashram College lectures. Prabhupada talked about teaching. We have to teach because people don't know. They don't know how to behave. They don't know how to behave in relation to their nature. And they don't know how to live off the land. So there's a tremendous job ahead of us in teaching. I say ahead of us because our life is to fulfill his ambitions. That's the purpose of servant, to fulfill the ambition of the master. That's the purpose of disciple. And that is our best interest. So I could see that Prabhupada visualized that the first half of his movement, this first 50%, if you will, was to basically establish Vaishnavism, to establish the mission of Mahaprabhu in the Western countries, to translate so many books, to inject the poisonous in one analogy that he gave, that it's already there. It can't be turned back. And coming to the end of his days, he felt great anxiety that there's not actual shelter for so many people who will take an interest in his books and the practice of chanting, who will not in this lifetime become pure devotees. If you notice, initially he expected everyone to become a pure devotee. Gradually in time, he saw that wasn't happening. And the evidence of that came to me in a number of statements he was making in his room. One of them, he said that, why so many fall downs? He said, do not make me like Alexander. Now we knew what he meant because he had earlier told us the same thing and he elaborated. Alexander the Great was known for conquering. And when he conquered a place, he would, of course, move on and conquer another place. So he had to leave an administration behind. But he was so bad at putting together administrations that everything was lost behind him. By the time he turned around from India and started heading back to Greece, most of what he had conquered was already in shambles or was in some kind of civil conflict or civil war internally amongst his own administrators, or they had been driven out and the place had been reconquered. So Prabhupada asked, don't make me like Alexander. So this again helps to illuminate his concern about the fall downs and the weaknesses. And he saw that so many angelic people were coming and wanting to serve God, accepting the words of Mahaprabhu, the words of our Guru Varga that came through his teaching and thoughts. So many good people, pious people, were ready to follow to some degree or another, but they were not in this lifetime realistically going to become Uttamadhikari. So where is that shelter? There's this phrase which of course really just came from an astrologer who claimed that Srila Prabhupada would build a house that the whole world could live in. And I think it's a very good phrase because that was certainly his concern. There was no limit to the concern that Srila Prabhupada had. It wasn't limited to those who were wearing tilak or who came to our ISKCON temples. Srila Prabhupada was concerned with everyone in this world. So up till now, our society has done very little to guide devotees through the maze of life's practical requirements, except to give the ultimate process. Having established a mission in the Western countries, Srila Prabhupada felt the need to also create a lifestyle that was compatible to Krishna consciousness as an alternative to the highly immoral and degrading host society of the Western world. A lifestyle that would both complement Krishna consciousness while solving the practical requirements to live within this world. Not only he wanted it, also his predecessor Acharyas wanted it. When ISKCON devotees living in the West face their householder years, they are usually left to fend for themselves, which most often means re-entering the Ugra Karma society that we ask them to leave initially to find some employment or start a business that can support their practical needs. Asking them to give their most productive younger years to serve the movement, the institution has a responsibility to see to their futures and offer them a secure environment for continuing their devotional lives. As the holy name alone, as the holy name becomes the center of more and more lives, our responsibility to guide these masses of fledgling devotees must include all stages of their lives. Failing to provide practical lifestyle that complements spiritual practice will significantly stunt our efforts to grow this movement and leave these devotees with the vexing problem of straddling two diametrically opposed worlds. The world where Krishna is the supreme personality of Godhead and the supreme enjoyer, and the world where sense enjoyment reigns supreme. So, in India, Srila Prabhupada preached very differently because India had a semblance of varnashram. India had a social network, a social safety net, guiding principles, morality. I remember in being a TP in India and having been a TP in America a few times, there was a contrast in how Srila Prabhupada dealt with young ladies. In India, he did not allow young ladies to join the temple. He preferred them to stay home. Because the home life was safer, it was usually better than ashram life. And of course, in India, if a lady lives in an ashram, she's not likely to ever get a good husband. Because ashrams are considered a rather dicey place to live. Things can go on in ashrams. India knows this, right? So, Srila Prabhupada dealt differently with India. Because already, so much was there. In America, there was just nothing. It was socially a desert. We were scrambling to redefine or to find some form of society. And from one generation to another, there was huge debate. That was, of course, the 60s was all about. We were debating. How do we live? What is society? What is right? What is wrong? Do we even need marriage? Do we need government? Right. So many things were being thrown up. So ISKCON in the West, and ISKCON in those days was primarily in the West, was just really getting started in India, was suffering because of this lack of a social and protective environment. Devotees were falling down for lack of being properly placed. I was just commenting earlier to some of my godbrothers that if some of our great leaders had not taken sannyas, they were such kshatriya natures, and had remained householders, they may have survived, those that had left. What used to be known as the Sun King at one time, who was ruling Europe, as an example. Great leader, but because he was in the mode of passion and acting as a celibate, this is an oxymoron. You can't do that. It's not done. In the old traditional mats, like if you go to Udupi, the Madhavacharya line is there, of course, and there are eight ashrams, eight mats that surround the temple. And each of those mats has senior sannyasis who are naishtika. And when they go out to walk on the street, there'll be 20 brahmacharis surrounding them, all chanting at the top of their lungs Vedic mantras. So not only can a woman not get near them, even a householder cannot get near them. It's like facing a football scrum. They move right through the crowd and everybody backs off like this. And that's how they protect their sannyasis. Right? So, having more knowledge of the different modes of nature and how one should be protected in that particular mode. There is it King, who is it, Priyavrata, who they wanted to appoint, correct me if I'm wrong, they wanted to appoint him, the demigods, as king, the universe, and he didn't want to, he was a celibate. Is it Priyavrata? Yes. And they said, no, you have to be married. You can't be a king without being married. This is an example. Because he was going to function in the mode of passion. The Brahmins had to churn the body of King Venu to create a kshatri. Because they couldn't do it. They can understand the ideals of what should be done, but they can't execute. A Brahmin cannot do that. He's not able. It's not in his nature. Was it Draupadi who forgave Ashwatthama? Ashwatthama, yes. She forgave him. All the Kshatriyas said, this is nuts. Cut his head off. She was a woman. She had a nature. But they gave her the decision. That nature cannot rule society. That nature rules from the crib. Right? The hand that rocks the cradle rules the world. So, there's a need for more understanding of the varnas and the natures and how we act in them. But as Daivi Varnashram, I'm going to move a little quickly through this now. As Daivi Varnashram has been described, a Vaishnava, one who's elevates, but he doesn't change hats and keep his danda and expect to work like a Kshatriya. That's a very slippery slope, and he's standing on wet grass, right? Because he's working in the mode of passion. And if he works still in the mode of goodness in a Brahminical mindset, he won't execute, and the society will be dissatisfied because he will not make decisions. Cannot. And justice delayed is justice denied. So the Brahmin tends to philosophize, prevaricate, you know, form committees, study it again, you know, make sure we get a unanimous vote. No. Kshatriya says, no. We're making a decision. We're moving on. It's abrupt, it's even offensive to some, but it's required. So that's the mode of passion, and there's the mode of goodness. So how we function, we have to divide ourselves appropriately. So this is a subject I really wanted to get to. Why 40 years have passed, and Srila Prabhupada was urgently, he was booking the tickets to come. We got all the way to London. On his way, that was a stopover to get to America, to do this. And now 40 years later, we haven't done it. Why? Okay. You know, I've heard various explanations. I've considered various explanations. I've heard some devotees say, well, when World War III comes and everything blows up and the zombies are coming down the street, then we'll all go do Varnashram. Right? Other devotees say, well, they're too attached to comforts. They don't want to be far away from a 7-Eleven. That's ridiculous. Come on. Devotees undergo all kinds of austerities. They change their lifestyle. They change their eating. They change their dress. Right? This is not a very good proposition. And obviously the first one needs little elaboration. It's quite silly, really. Quite childish. Right? What are you waiting for World War III? Your goose is cooked right now. The privileged few have declared war on you, on Mother Earth, on Mother Cow. They're feeding you poison. They're pumping your lungs with polluted air, polluted water. Killing Mother Cow. Come on. That World War III would just be, you know, a footnote in history. The real devastation is already going on. So what are the obstacles? I suggest that the real problem is, just like when you come to a room that's dark, you hesitate to go in. You can't see what's there. You don't know how to step. So you stop. It's not that you're insincere to enter the room. If Prabhupada told you to go in that room, you want to go in the room, but you'll give pause if it's dark. I don't know where I should go, how I should go. And so I think that these type of conferences, these type of discussions, books need to be written, analysis of what it is, how to do it, how to practically move forward. And for me, and I suggest this for all of you to consider, Srila Prabhupada gave me the answer. He gave me the beej when I asked him, how will you do it? And he said, I will sit down and I will teach you how to live off the land. So, as we've said from different angles, Tukaram Prabhu also reiterated this. It's living off the land. That's not in the city. That's not in the IT department. That's not in the bank. It's living on the land. It's using our intelligence with how to live on the land. Yes. Now, part of the hesitation, and I think a very important part that needs to be called out, we have amongst us, because we're idealists, and we're absolutists, and we like things that are very strong and black and white and clear. So there's a lot of sympathy to fundamentalism, which, of course, verges on error and often crosses that line. In relation to Varnashram, there is a buzzword I mentioned earlier in a question I raised or a comment I made, this concept of buzzword. Buzzwords are words which just somehow slip right past our discriminating frontal lobe and just we accept, Varnashram, self-sufficiency. That's the word I want to go after. Self-sufficiency. Can anyone tell me what that means? I'll save the time. You all can give me a different definition, and there won't be one that'll be the same. Does it mean we go out into the Yukon with our trusty musket and axe and we start building the house and, you know, carving out a life for ourselves? Or do we take our wife? Well, wait a minute, I'm not self-sufficient now. I've got two people working. And then we have some children, and they're helping too. And then, I have a neighbor, and by the way, he's a nice guy. He comes over and helps out too. What does it mean? Right? Srila Prabhupada was not a fanatic. He was a fanatic for Krishna. And he has made very clear statements that our goal is to achieve Krishna consciousness and create an environment that supports Krishna consciousness. The fundamentalists in our movement, amongst us, and even within our own selves, defeat us before we get started. Because they propose a level of 17th century, 18th century, which is impossible today. There's text and context, right? The context of living in living on the land, living in self-sufficiency, if you want to duplicate what happened in another context, you have to duplicate the context. In the 16th century, 18th century, 19th century, nobody paid for land. Nobody paid for land. Your feudal lord, your raja, your father, all gave it to you. Or you bought a few bullets and killed the natives and took it. The idea of buying land was a bizarre idea. In my youth, let's say 50 years ago, you could have bought farmland anywhere in the United States for $100 an acre. And most of the old-time farmers thought that was nuts. Right? They couldn't imagine it, $100 an acre. I remember I had an uncle who was a farmer, actually a great uncle. And we used to go to the farm regularly. And they had this attitude. I inherited it. You know, we bought it for $5 an acre so long ago. So practically they didn't pay for it. Until the capitalists started investing. And big agro started buying. You know? Now remember, this is a recent phenomenon. The industrialization of food. In the 1920s, 75% of the United States were farm families, farm communities. Today, I think it's below 10%. Right? That's a new phenomenon. It happened very recently. They were wiped out. They were wiped out by inheritance tax. They were wiped out by the capitalists and big agro. Inheritance tax, basically, you inherited a property generation after generation, then the new tax came in, and one fine day, the tax man says, well, your father died and your farm is worth $6 million. And the son says, golly, $6 million? I never saw $6,000. Well, sorry, but you owe 50% of the value of this farm. What am I going to do? You're going to sell it. And you're going to move to the city because you're going to have a nice nest egg of $3 million after you pay us our $3 million. This destroyed the family farm. Big agro was right there to buy it. But big agro didn't suffer for that land. They didn't toil it for three generations, four generations. Nor did they even toil to get that $6 million to buy it. They went to the investment bankers who printed funny money. They didn't suffer for it either. And so the land has been stolen from the people. Today, to say, go back and farm the land, how do I acquire that much capital? How do I buy farmland? These are the problems. How do I deal with the zoning board? I have to build a house. I have to follow the regulations. There are so many circumstances. What to speak of my lack of ability to produce for myself? So many items. Right? So this fundamentalism, it stymies the imagination of the devotees. Good-hearted devotees. Devotees are ready to sacrifice. They're ready to do anything for Prabhupada. But if they can't figure out how to do it, what will they do? They'll freeze. They don't know what to do. So, where are we? Okay. Pancharatna is suggesting I move forward. Yes. Thank you, Prabhu. So, Prabhupada always endorsed embracing of the practical. Aim at the final goal, even if we can't fully see how to get there. Start moving in small steps forward. These gave us some key principles for how he was defining Varnashram for us. Right? Living off the land was primary. Intimate relationships to Mother Earth and Mother Cow is a part of that, living off the land. Then there's a natural and dignified division of labor. There's complementary roles and parameters to those roles. This is Varnashram in a broad definition. The what is that word? There's a Sanskrit word, I'll find it in a minute, that refers to dignified lifestyle. In the In the initial contemplation of Varnashram, there's a bit of hesitation that, oh my God, they're finally going to discover that I'm actually a Sudra. Well, Ramananda Roy was a Sudra, and he was most dear to Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Entertainers are Sudras. Dance instructors are Sudras. Right? Employed people are Sudras. People who work for someone else are Sudras. It's not an undignified position. In fact, the majority of Vedic society were Sudras. Right? There were Kshatriyas who went to hell, who had no chance to go back to Godhead. And there are so many Sudras who became saints. So our goal is to achieve Krishna. Our goal is to achieve Krishna collectively and individually. Our society is a society for Krishna consciousness. Think about that. A society for achieving Krishna consciousness. We work together to achieve Krishna consciousness. How do we organize ourselves? We have a rather simple organizational structure in the temple, in the ISKCON society we have today. Varnashram is an elaboration, an extension of that. So that more and more people can come under the gamut of Varnashram. Oh, I'm completely lost in my notes, so I'll just follow those. How will Varnashram look in the 21st century America? As I mentioned earlier, I don't think Srila Prabhupada saw the L.A. Temple on La Cienega Boulevard or 55th Street Temple in Manhattan. I think he understood that Lord Chaitanya's movement would spread far and wide, but exactly how it would happen, that there would be a Vishnu Jan Swami, that there would be a Tamal Krishna Goswami, that there would be a Brahmananda, that there would be so many different personalities. These things came and the society took on a character from the collective persons and opportunities that the Lord gave. So how will Varnashram look in the future? Certainly It will be devotee communities living off of the land. That will not occur in the city. The city is a very simple, there's a simple result to living in the city. You work for a demoniac enterprise, or you start a business and you serve other people who work for the demoniac enterprises, and you collectively still serve the overall, just like New York City. New York City is the place where the capitalists basically rule the world. They call the shots in Washington. They call the shots in the wars that take place in Africa when, you know, when BHP or De Beers or someone needs a new mining lease, somehow or another, money goes to some new upstart rebel and he kills off the old government. And when he comes in, yes, they get a mining lease. All these decisions take place in the cities. New York City happens to be one of the capitals of this. And if we are living and working in the city, we are directly or indirectly a part of that demoniac system. There is a collective karma that we inherit by living in the cities. It's a very negative atmosphere. Immorality is celebrated. Right? So, and just for a devotee to survive in that city life, he's either preaching, in which case, just like in our Harinam ashram in New York City, we go out in the middle of New York City, we chant kirtan, and we don't feel affected. We're actually protected by a bubble of the holy name. But without that, if we're moving around trying to earn our living, then we're become heavily contaminated. So Prabhupada wanted the devotees, because of the fall downs, to be protected. So it will be communities living off the land. This is a repeat of a quote that Tukaram Prabhu mentioned from Prabhupada's talk in Moscow with Professor Katovsky, where he does say that our point is not to try to bring back the old type of Hindu society. That is impossible. Our idea is to take the best ideas from the original idea. Now, it's not that we don't look to old Indian civilization. In fact, Srila Prabhupada many times used to refer how things were done, how things were, right? Because these are the best anecdotes that give us ideas of how we can move forward. Another key component, Tukaram Prabhu mentioned also, is Mother Earth and Mother Cow. They become members of our community. We become members of their community, because they are going on with their community affairs, blessings. This is the most loving and kind community. Mother Earth takes so much abuse, and we pound around on her with so much arrogance and destructive spirit, and still she blesses us with a beautiful morning and beautiful breeze and food to eat and fresh water to drink and bathe in, despite our demoniac behaviors. Mother Cow continues to chew on the grass in spite of the fact that millions and billions of her sisters are being slaughtered and butchered worldwide. Still, she's ready to bless us. So they already have a community, a loving community, and they're eager to embrace us. So that is an aspect of Varnashram that will clearly be there. I'll just take a minute to mention that Mother Cow was originally a gift from the Devtas to the residents of Earth, because she is like an alchemist. She takes the weeds and the grasses that we can't eat, and she turns them into the most beneficial food that the human body can take in. If you had nothing but milk, everything is there. Milk, ghee. These items are the greatest gift to the human being. Especially, now you hear a lot of propaganda about the veganism today. And they say that the milk is not fit for us, that humans have a different digestive system. And that may be true for the GMO cows, like the Holsteins, which are basically genetically bred or genetically managed, I should say. And they've evolved a certain protein type, which is not compatible. But many cows, especially all of the humpback cows, all of the zebus, and even some of the old breeds in the West, such as our brown Swiss, which we have here. Brown Swiss are primarily A2. The scientists have labeled A1 and A2 protein. The casein format is A1 or A2. And A2 is exactly like mother's milk. A1 is what the Holstein produces. And when you drink that milk, I know when I drink that milk, I'm immediately choking, gagging on mucus. Well, you can bring me a gallon of this Vidanagari milk or a gallon of a good Indian cow's milk, and it just goes right through and just digests perfectly because it resembles the human milk. Marsh?
You have 8 minutes.
Okay. So cow is very important. So back to Srila Prabhupada's statement to make Vaikuntha world. Community that's working together on the same general economic enterprise of living off the land. This is also what binds a community together when we have a common economic enterprise. If we're each going off to our different jobs, we're working for a different demon here and there. The only thing that binds us together is our spiritual commonality and our good-heartedness. But when that economic factor comes in, that it completely tightens the whole community together because we're interdependent. We're not only supporting each other spiritually, but at every level. So a Varnashram village, it's an interdependent social and economic group of families. The labor, of course, is divided according to the ability and nature. It's rooted in agriculture and cow protection. Everyone contributes their defined work. Capital is primarily accumulated in the state or the village head. Today we see the Vaishyas have captured the capital. And in fact, in old times, Vaishyas were not allowed to acquire capital. It was taken by the Kshatriyas. They were allowed to perform their service and have just what they needed to continue. Because the Vaishya, you see what they do. That India today is primarily ruled by Vaishyas. The Birlas, the Adanis, the Advani, they're all Vaishyas. And they're ravaging India, and they're ravaging the people. Right? And the same thing, of course, America is a Vaishya empire. What makes it Daivi Varnashram? There's a quote you'll see, I think, in Shivaram Maharaj's presentation, which you'll see tomorrow, or is it later today? Where he mentions Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati, saying that the fact that you can move according to your nature in different dharmas, different varnas, is one aspect. And, of course, the other aspect, Daiva Varnashram, I'll take the correction of Tukaram Prabhu, is that the whole community is come together under the Sankirtan Jagya to celebrate the holy name of Krishna. In the Kali Yuga, in every Yuga, you have to worship as prescribed by the Yuga Avatar. And the Yuga Avatar in the Kali Yuga has been declared as Krishna, Black Krishna, the same Krishna who was the Yuga Avatar in Dwapara Yuga. But in Kali Yuga, he's been touched by Srimati Radharani's mood, and he's become golden on the outside. This is Srila Jiva Goswami's explanation. The word gram, it's rooted in the word gru, gruha, which also griha. It basically refers to a family. And a village is like a family. In a family, I want to mention something here that's very important to us in America, which is steeped in egalitarianism. The earth is not flat. And a Varnashram society is hierarchical, just as the cosmology, Vedic cosmology, is hierarchical. Family of a grandfather. The children don't envy the grandfather, nor do they disobey the grandfather. The grandfather is the authority. You'll have a father, you'll have a mother, you'll have uncles and aunties, you'll have children, right? It's hierarchical. Every successful human organization is hierarchical. The army, the government. There's no such thing as a flat earth. Right? And the universe is not flat. So this has infected, I think, to a certain degree, our minds in America and the Western countries, that for probably a lack of a better alternative, we all scramble for equality. And there's a lack of understanding of the various tiers of elders and the various tiers of positions in society. It's not that a kshatriya rules all aspects of society. In fact, a sudra saint may have far more spiritual influence and even emotional influence on the people than the king. But practical organization may be done by the kshatriya. So it's a very complex organization, and it adapts to the circumstances. Again, there's no freeze frame time where you can say that was the Vedic time. It doesn't exist. It was constantly evolving and transmuting. And there were Brahmin villages with no kshatriyas and hardly any sudras. There were sudra villages in Tamal Krishna's Jagannath Priyanatakam, the play about the appearance of Lord Jagannath. He mentions the Sabaras, who were pig herders, and there was a Sabara king who was a pig herder. So all types of permutations occur. But it's not that everyone is equal in this material sphere. Different roles and different status according to their natural position. The idea was that we are working together for nischinta jivan, the spiritual life, the life free of material attachment. Whoa. Okay. There's a large part of this presentation which I'll have to skip, which I've spent some years researching Indian village life in the past, and referenced a lot of things that were written by different scholars that I knew myself, and coming out of also the influence of an ashram called Kala Ashram, which studied Varnashram and how it manifested in the villages. So there's a lot of anecdotal information I have, and I've left it in my paper, which Panchratna will make available for those who want to go into that. Primarily, Varnashram was a gifting economy. It was not even as much based on trade, but just like Arjuna was given the opportunity to fight as a kshatriya because it was his duty, the individual in the Varnashram family felt an honor to be able to serve according to his duty. The stomach, when it's prepared to do its duty, doesn't ask, did the arm do its duty today? Or does the arm owe me anything before I process this food? The stomach's dharma is to undertake its role as a food processor. So everyone in a Varnashram society feels honored to carry their load without... as a practical example, the blacksmith in a traditional village, he would receive the plow that was broken from the farmer in the evening. And he would count it, was finished, he would place it back out without making a note in any journal that this farmer owes me money. The farmer would come and take it and go back and plow the field. Now in that farmer's field, according to his religious obligations, he had designated certain parts of the field which belonged to different jatis in the village. And when the harvest came, that portion was given to that jati, whether or not he had performed any service in that year. He may not have had a broken plow that year. Still he gave the food. It's like a family. It's like a family. The grandfather or the father doesn't bring the food to the table and say, well, this son hasn't done his duty for a whole week, so he's not eating today. Right? This is not the way it is. It's a loving community. Trade was there for outside of the community, primarily, and somewhat within the community. Today, we have a need for practical interaction with the modern world. We don't have a great ruler who's and a tradition of thousands of years of Varnashram where the entire society around us is living in the same way. So to practically interact with the outside world, we must engage in some commerce. And I'll build on this theme a little more tomorrow, where I'll talk about our practical proposal to manifest Varnashram in relation to New York City and a farm that will be hopefully acquired soon just outside of New York City. So, in summary, I think I've stressed this numerous times now. It's pragmatic. I'll start from the bottom. We take the shelter of Mother Cow and therefore Mother Earth as well. We live off the land. This is the healthy environment with which Varnashram can come up. And tomorrow I'll make a practical sort of proposal as to how we envision doing that. So may I take a few questions before I'm pulled off the stage? Prabhu.
Which one?
So I understand now that Varnashram is mainly about living off the land, interacting with Mother Cow. But when we talk about Varnashram in ISKCON, our main idea is to propagate the mission of Lord Chaitanya. So how are we going to do that if we are doing it in, because Varnashram mainly is possible mostly in the rural areas. In cities there is no land. So how will that be manifested?
Well, I'll elaborate tomorrow, but I'm going to argue that without instituting Varnashram, we are purposely stunting, inhibiting Lord Chaitanya's movement. Because there are so many people that need shelter, and ISKCON as it's structured today is not offering the shelter that they need. I sit in Harinam and we watch 4 million people a year come right within the kirtan sound, right, in Union Square and other places around New York. So many of them walk by, give us a thumbs up, put some money in the basket. They like that we're there. They never dream about joining because they don't see that we offer a practical way for them to live. They can't imagine. Many of us in this room don't live in the ashram. We work outside for somebody else. So this is to extend the shelter. As I mentioned earlier in the talk, the astrologer said Srila Prabhupada would build a house that the whole world could live in. Putting the roof on that house, finishing that house. They certainly can't all move in to the temple. They're not equipped. Raj Bihari Prabhu. All right.
Prabhu, you could ask Prabhuji after. So thank you very much, Abhiram Prabhu.